this audience can recall, in essence, Joseph Smith's story of how the place came forth. For example, William Smith makes an interesting comment that Joseph came in and he said, "Father, I have the plates." When the plates were brought in, they were wrapped in a tophrach. My father then put them into a pillowcase. Father said, "What, Joseph, can we not see them?" "No, I was disobedient the first time," Joseph said. "But I intend to be faithful this time, for I was forbidden to show them until they are translated, but you could feel them." That gives you kind of a beginning comment about the plates and how they were initially dealt with. I won't go into the details of the Urim and Thummim. That, of course, was described best, I think, by Lucy Mack Smith's description. The Urim and Thummim was basically two smooth, three-cornered diamonds set in glass, and the glasses were set in silver bows. And you put on a set of spectacles and use these for translation. Interestingly, while Joseph had the plates, they were apparently hidden. Joseph Knight states that they were hidden in a brick hearth in the west room where the Smiths were staying. Lucy Mack Smith said they were to be hidden in a log. These events are straightforward, clear, and seem to be interpreted that they were here and now real plates. At least that's what everybody assumed was the case. Now, one of the first important questions then was, how did the translation actually occur? Again, summarizing the evidence, it suggested that the 116 pages of the Book of Mormon that were later lost by Oliver Cowdery and his wife, whatever, were translated by the use of the Urim and Thummim. As you may recall, that was a very traumatic experience for Joseph, and he had to supplicate the Lord for some time to get the power back to translate. And then later he translated what we now have as the Book of Mormon, retranslating not those first 116 pages, but the small place of Nephi, and then the rest of the Book of Mormon. This is what Emma Smith said. "Now, the first that my husband translated was translated by use of the Urim and Thummim, and that was in the part that Martin Harris lost, and that my husband then used a small stone, not exactly black, but was rather a dark color." Later, in an interview in 1885, David Whitmer said that he was one of the three witnesses, of course, that as a punishment for having lost 116 pages of translation, Moroni did not return to Smith with the original Urim and Thummim found in the plates, but allowed him to translate with the seer stone he already possessed. Now, there's confusion in Mormon literature. Sometimes this seer stone is referred to as a Urim and Thummim rather loosely. Bruce R. McConkie makes this point. But we should keep in mind what happened then was that the Book of Mormon as we have it was translated with the seer stone. And then it's described in various ways, too, again, which I won't take the time to do. The translation process was outlined in this way by William Blair, who stated, "The mode of procedure consisted in Joseph's placing the seer stone in the crown of a hat, then putting his face into the hat so as to entirely cover his face, resting his elbows upon his knees, and then dictating word after word while the scribe, Emma, John Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, or some other, wrote it down." That seems to be the best evidence as to how the translation went. Now, an important question would be, how did the translation process go forth in terms of the plates, in the connection with the plates? Now, this would seem to be almost an obvious question that's never asked. Surprisingly, however, the assumption that, for example, the plates were used in the translation is answered in the negative. In other words, the primary witnesses, at least all that we have, state that the plates were not used in the translation. They all point to the fact that basically Joseph then used the stone of the interpreters, using his hat, shutting out the light, and then doing the translation, and then producing the record. For example, the various witnesses said this: the plates lay on the table and were wrapped in a small linen cloth, Emma Smith. They were in a box, Martin Harris. They were hid in the woods, Isaac Hale. He did not use the plates in the translation, according to David Whitmer. They were in the mountains, according to Joseph Smith Sr. Now, it is important to emphasize that even though the plates were not present, one of the scribes, Emma Smith, assumed that Joseph was making the translation from the plates, or that his knowledge that came from the plates was the basis of the translation. Note what she says. "I wrote for Joseph Smith during the work of translation, as did also Reuben Hale and Oliver Cowdery. The larger part of this labor was done in my presence, where I could see and know what was being done. During no part of it did Joseph have any manuscript or book of any kind from which to read or dictate, except the metallic plates which I knew he had. Joseph Smith could neither write nor dictate a coherent and well-worded letter, let alone dictate a book like the Book of Mormon. Now, that was Emma's description. Now, it's interesting. Some of the critics now say that Joseph must have written the Book of Mormon with the King James Version of the Bible at his side because there are so many direct quotes or almost quotes from the King James translation. That's what most of some of the modern critics about the Book of Mormon are really saying, but Emma's testimony would controvert that. In essence, she was saying that the plates were nearby, perhaps, but the translation process went on the way she described it without anything nearby. Another interesting corollary to be thinking about with this is that later Oliver Cowdery actually learned that Joseph did not need plates to translate because in reference to John the Revelator, Joseph translated a parchment that had been hidden up by John himself. This led to the revelation seen in Doctrine and Covenants, Section 7, LDS edition. Now, if you'll recall, that revelation states, the background of that revelation states that Joseph saw a parchment and then in vision translated the parchment into this revelation. And that comes closer to, in fact, what was done with the Book of Mormon. And as some of the witnesses then concluded, they state that basically Joseph Smith was a reader. Joseph used a seer stone upon which appeared the writing that he would read off the translation into English. So I think that's the best description that we have of how he really did this. Now, there's an alternate view of the translation process. Some writers, and one of them was B.H. Roberts and others, felt that he did not translate by reading the letters visually, but they did it conceptually, like an ordinary translator would do. The ideas would come into his mind, and then he would put them into modern English. And, of course, that was the rationale for explaining why there was so much King James Version of the Bible in the Book of Mormon, and so many modern idioms that related to the 19th century, which, of course, is now one of the raging debates. Is the Book of Mormon basically a product of the 19th century and written with an accumulation of 19th century ideas and the writings of the King James Bible? The trouble with this second idea that he did it conceptually is that most of the basis for this comes from Doctrine and Covenants section 6, 8, and 9, where the Lord, for example, talks about studying things out in your mind first. The thing, though, that one has to remember is that these revelations were primarily for Oliver Cowdery, not Joseph Smith. And so I think the argument is not strong at all that this was a conceptual translation. The primary witnesses, as I said, give us a far stronger testimony that Joseph did it visually. He was a visionary person. He was a seer, in fact. And then we ought to remember what B.H. Roberts himself said to Wesley P. Lloyd. The plates were not objective, but subjective with Joseph Smith. Now, if this, in general, is what happened, a recurring question would be, what was the necessity of having the plates at all? If he, for example, could translate a parchment from John without the necessity of the parchment, what's the necessity of the plates? Couldn't the Book of Mormon come forth without the plates? Actually, the answer could well be logically, well, yeah, he didn't need the plates at all. Well, but then again, if that is the case, we are back to the question, why was such an issue of the plates made then? What are we talking about here? What's going on? Well, let me take another line of reasoning here that might be a little bit different than you've heard, but just follow along with me for a moment here. Don't doubt me too soon, Tom. I have one of my best critics in the audience here. He just walked in, so I have to watch my P's and Q's here.
Doubting Thomas.
Right, Doubting Thomas. Certainly one might argue that the plates would be very important as a tangible evidence for the fact that he was a prophet and had what he claimed, as well as give a connection to the naturalistic world from which he was going, from which he was connecting to the spiritual world. I found a striking parallel with what may have happened to Joseph Smith concerning the plates with a shamanic practice amongst a certain Indian tribe in South America, the Jivaro Indians. Their curing shamans describe the following sorts of experiences. These shamans or healers possess a special spirit helper they call Sensak. These are described as spiritual beings that shamans claim assist them in their role as healers. They believe these helpers have supernatural powers that can cause and cure illness. They can even cause death. They're used to fight off evil. For example, bewitching shamans use them to inflict evil or illness on people. Conversely, curing shamans may have to suck these beings out of people in order to save them from death or illness. Now, according to the Havaro, each sensak, or each one of these spirit beings, actually has a natural and a spiritual aspect. The natural aspect would be an ordinary object, such as an insect, a bug or a beetle of some kind, for example, that would be present in the environment. However, the spiritual, or what they call the non-ordinary aspect or nature, which is its true aspect, one has to go into vision to see. But it's very real. It's just as real as this material object it can appear in ordinary life. But you have to go into vision to get a picture of what this spirit helper is like and to understand its true spiritual nature. Now, in its spiritual form, they may appear in a variety of different forms, such as giant butterflies, jaguars, monkeys, or some other animal, usually. So in other words, there's this natural or ordinary aspect, which is a beetle or a worm, and then there's the spiritual aspect taking on these more colorful forms. Now, in the illness-producing process, the following occurs. A bewitching shaman may send one of these spirits into a person to make him ill or try to kill him. Curing shaman then has a complementary job to do. He will try to make a diagnosis and form a treatment plan for the patient. The curing shaman himself will take go into trance, often by a hallucinogenic drug, or not necessarily so. However, he goes into trance. He will go into trance. And this will permit him to see into the body of the patient as if it were like glass. He will then be able to see the spirit helper, or the spirit itself, that has been placed in the body by the bewitching shaman. This will take place at night, in the session at night. After he has located this spirit in the body of the patient, the curing shaman will then be ready to suck that spirit out of the victim or the patient who is ill. Now, in order to do that, the curing shaman will regurgitate two of his own spirit helpers from within himself. In other words, prior to the healing ceremony, he will have swallowed, for example, a worm or a beetle or something. And in the middle of the performance now, he will regurgitate that and bring it up into his mouth and put it in his mouth by his throat. Now, mind you, that's the natural form of this spirit being. He will place these two in his throat and his mouth, and he will see the supernatural aspect of the similar form of the spirit inside the victim's body. And then he will go through an experience where he will suck this spirit out into his mouth, and he will catch it in his mouth. And the one nearest his lips will incorporate that sucked out spirit into itself. However, if for some reason it gets past that one, he has another one as a safety valve to catch it. Because he's very frightened, because if it goes down his throat, he himself will be in danger of becoming very ill. So what in essence he does is he takes the natural aspect of this spiritual entity and takes its spiritual aspect and incorporates it in the natural aspect and has it in his mouth, and then he will vomit it out or take it out of his mouth and show the patients. And he will say, "Now I've sucked it out. Here it is. Here is the illness we have taken out of your body that was in, let's say, your stomach." Now, let me just quote Michael Harner, who did the original research on this. "The non-shamans think that the material object itself is what has been sucked out, and the shaman does not disillusion them. At the same time, he's not lying, because he knows that the only important thing about a spirit such as this is its supernatural aspect, or essence, which he sincerely believes he has removed from the patient's body. To explain to the layman that he already had these objects, these material objects, in his mouth, would serve no fruitful purpose and would prevent him from displaying such an object as proof that he effected the cure. Without incontrovertible evidence, he would not be able to convince the patient and his family that he had effected the cure and therefore he must be paid." Well, this is an interesting experience. We, of course, with our 20th century mentality, can immediately suspect charlatanism or whatever. But very seriously, you see, these people's view of the world begins with an assumption we don't have, and that is that this spiritual or other world is just exactly as real as the material world. They're just different worlds. They're just different forms of reality. One is not any more important than the other. And in case you think this doesn't happen in our culture, we've had people, I have seen people who have this ability talk about things in people's bodies in the same kind of way. And maybe in our discussion I'll give you an example of that. And so now I just raise a question for you. Could it be, in a similar sense, that the golden plates, and in the same fashion as the materialistic aspect of these spirit helpers in the mouth of the shaman, that are used to catch the spiritual aspect of the spirit itself, causing the illness, were present as material objects to validate the more visionary and spiritual world of Joseph Smith? In other words, what I'm saying, were the gold plates in some ways, maybe we don't know completely their function in terms of the translation process, but did they in fact have the function of showing the people in a real and here and now way that indeed Joseph Smith had something that is material in this world that relates to this other world he was trying to communicate, i.e. that world of the Nephites and what the Book of Mormon was about? In other words, it was a way of bridging the gap between these two realities. And as Michael Quinn has shown in his book, in Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, we have to have a totally different mindset to think of what those people understood as to how the world operated as compared to our 20th century world. As you think about that, let me try to extend this a little bit more about some of the other aspects of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon that many of you may not have heard about that go into this very thing. Now, as you know, Doctrine and Covenants section 17 is a revelation during the witnesses. And it gives specific instruction to them about how their eyes will see by the power of God. They are to testify what they have seen and to show by the power of God that Joseph Smith has these plates and the translation work is true. And I won't read that, but you can refer back to it if you'd like. Again, they're also shown the director, the Liahona, and many of the paraphernalia that Joseph received during his time. But again, it was emphasized that faith was the way this would come forth. Now let's move on to the three special witnesses and their experience. Now again, as many of you recall, after this revelation, Joseph took Martin Harris, David Whitman, and Oliver Cowdery to a secluded place. And as Joseph said, in quotes, "According to previous arrangements, I commenced by vocal prayer to our Heavenly Father and was followed by each of the rest in succession. We did not yet, however, obtain any answer or manifestation of the divine favor in our behalf. We again observed the same order of prayer, each calling on and praying fervently to God in rotation, with the same result as before. After the second failure, then Martin Harris proposed he withdraw himself. Somehow he felt he may have been interfering with things. After he receded, then the air changed. There was a brightness. And as Joseph said, behold, an angel stood before us. In his hands he held the plates, which he'd been praying for. And they had a view of the plates. The angel then turned over the leaves of the plates one by one so that he could see them and discover the engravings thereon distinctly. He addressed himself to David Whitmer and said, David, blessed is the Lord, and he that keeps his commandments. And after that, we heard a voice from out of the bright light upon us saying, these plates have been revealed by the power of God, and they have been translated by the power of God. The translation of them which you have seen is correct, and I command you to bear record now what you see. Well, after this, Joseph describes how he left David and Oliver and went to Martin and essentially repeated the experience and stated that they had the same experience take place. Then, of course, there's the famous statement of the testimony, the three witnesses summarizing this. And again, I won't go into that, but basically it indicates that they saw the engravings upon the plates, they saw the plates, the angel showed them to them, and they have seen the plates and bore record. But now it's very interesting. Later, when Zenas Gurley interviewed David Whitmer about this experience, these are some of the questions he asked. Did you see an actual table? Answer. Do you see the small table by the wall? Well, there was a table about that size, and the heavenly messenger brought the plates and laid them on the table before our eyes, and we saw them. Question. Did you handle the plates? Answer. I did not handle the plates. I only saw them. Joseph and I think Oliver and Emmett told me about the plates, described them to me. And I believe him, but did not see, except at the time, testify them. He also testified he then also indicated he saw the sealed part. And the angel turning over the leaves. Milton Backman points out that later in his dying testimony, Martin Harris made a statement that to someone that he did handle the plates, but even Backman interprets this as maybe again referring to the visionary more experience rather than the actual handling of the plates. Now, the other testimony of the eight witnesses is a little different. It talks about actually handling the plates and hefting them. And so that testimony now is a little more formidable to look at, because it sounds like this was a very natural process. They took the place, they had him, and that was it. Hiram Smith said the same thing. However, even these testimonies have to be, even the testimony of the eight witnesses has to be qualified by later statements. First, we must remember that the power of these testimonies have to be placed in context with the worldview at that time. We know that treasure-seeking groups, and of which the Smiths were a member, and all these were members of a treasure-seeking group, often claim experiences of sinking chests and spiritual experiences very real to them that had the quality, basically, of a visionary experience. For example, Joseph indicated he could see and behold things not visible to the natural eye. Harris, one time, for example, noted that he saw the place, but they were covered with a cloth. In other words, when you pin down specific statements about the presence of the plates in its more naturalistic form, it was always with a covered cloth or something to that nature. And now let me recite another quote Brigham Young made about Oliver Cowdery. This is also verified in other sources. Brigham Young said, "Oliver Cowdery says that when Joseph and Oliver went there, the hill opened," this is the hill Cumorah, "and they walked into a cave in which there was a large and spacious room. He says he did not think at the time whether they had the light of the sun or artificial light, but that it was just as light as day. They laid the place on a table. It was a large table that stood in the room. Under this table there was a pile of plates as much as 2 feet high, and they were all together in this room, more plates than probably many wagon loads. They were piled up in the corners and along the walls. The first time they went there, the sword of Laban hung upon the wall. But when they went out again, it had been taken down and laid upon the table across the place." And Brigham goes on to cite this as witnesses to the foundation of Mormonism. Now, some people, of course, feel this was, again, a literal naturalistic experience. But the way it's described, commensurate with so many of the other experiences, this would appear to be a visionary experience. It was part of what they called, in those days, the second sight. The second sight experience. The conversations, the ancient inhabitants of the land. Many of these things that Joseph Smith described were not just limited to him. Many of these people described these kinds of visionary experiences. Again, in trance. In another account, for example, "We found a stone box and were ready to take it up, but behold, by some unseen power, it slipped back into the hill." See, this almost sounds a little bit like the Jivaro Indians, this fusion of the spiritual reality and the material reality, if you read it carefully. So in summary, I would say if these accounts are examined carefully, we have to really look at this naturalistic versus spiritual way of responding to these witnesses' experiences, both the three witnesses and the eight witnesses. For example, James H. Moyle, who was a hard-nosed attorney, he was the father of Henry Moyle, by the way, he is a young Mormon attorney, interviewed David Whitmer, and later in his journal wrote, "Whitmer was somewhat spiritual in his explanations. He was not as naturalistic in his descriptions as I wished." So you see, there's that 20th century mentality already sneaking into the picture here. Moyle later further quoted, "Whitmer repeated to me that he did see and handle a place, that he did see and hear an angel, and yet Moyle also said that Whitmer did not handle a place physically. So he only saw it." Moving to the eight witnesses. For example, Stephen Burnett, who was one of the group that left the church, made this comment, and a number of other comments could be made along these lines. This was in 1838 when there was the apostasy that took place and many of the leaders left the church. In a 15 April 1838 letter, Burnett said this. He was a 70, by the way. "When I came to hear Martin Harris state in public that he never saw the place with his natural eyes, only in vision or imagination, neither Oliver nor David, and also that the eight witnesses never saw them and hesitated to sign that instrument for that reason, but were persuaded to do it, the last pedestal gave way, in my view. Our foundation was sapped, and the entire superstructure fell in a heap of ruins." End of quote. Now, you can see, again, what was going on there. Later, for example, Harris noted that he never saw the place, only as you see a city through a mountain, was some of the terms he used. So, basically, a lot of the evidence certainly can be concluded to be that both the three and the eight witnesses had visionary experiences concerning their testimony of the place, and that a naturalistic handling of them was really not what took place. Now, in attempting to harmonize this with one's faith, a number of profound questions, of course, come to mind. I've already raised the question about the necessity of the plates. But if these questions can be raised, and one can see now why anti-Mormons are raising them, and particularly with our 20th century mindset, we might have some very serious problems here. However, I maintain and submit to you this. The crisis need not be so devastating to one's faith if one can now begin to look at these experiences from a different perspective. That perspective would be to note, as I've tried to note in recent publications, that Joseph Smith basically was operating like a shamanic personality. These are the kinds of individuals who go into trance, into the other world, and connect that world to this world, much like some of these Havara shamans I've been describing. Now, that may be something you don't, as modern Mormons, like to have done to your dear prophet Joseph, and he's dear to me too. But I would hope that you can set aside some of those feelings and realize that some of these, in quotes, primitive-sounding medicine men are not so naive or not so simplistic or primitive as may seem. They're really, in fact, and now I've met some of them, quite sophisticated and quite serious-minded people who do just as serious work as we do. And I'll tell you, some of the healings and cures they perform on people are every bit as impressive as the ones I think I do. So now, that being the case, let me just, that being the line of reasoning here, I would like to suggest then that Joseph and the witnesses were engaging in a species of collective dreaming or collective vision, a phenomenon actually that's been studied in various cultures. And again, shamanic cultures would be the ones to study in this area. Our Western cultures do not give much credence to this until just recent times, and it's still a very small group that does it. Now remember, in these cultures, visionary states are accepted as standard and just as important as the natural world experiences. Now for example, if we take Doctrine and Covenants section 17 as a preamble to those witnesses' experiences, we have already a setting coming through the revelations of the Lord for Joseph to come together with the witnesses in a very profoundly, deeply moving way. In fact, we could postulate that the communication level was going to be so profound that probably telepathic means of communication was going to be going on. So that in coming together, that they were going to have experiences that would activate both of their connections to each other at a very deep unconscious level. Now, in 1902, I.W. Riley, a psychologist, stated that Joseph Smith hypnotized the witnesses to get them to state that they saw what he wanted them to see. This criticism has been dismissed by many feeling it was too grandiose, yet many anti-Mormons have quoted it. Actually, Riley's statement is a bit far-fetched. He didn't know that much about hypnosis. Nevertheless, he may have been closer to the truth than we realize. It would certainly not be accurate to say that Joseph Smith consciously manipulated and hypnotized witnesses. Rather, a more accurate statement psychologically might be that Joseph was in tune with him, and together they collectively went into an altered state of consciousness where these collective dreaming states could occur. Now, it's in those states that the barriers go down and people begin to see and feel and hear and experience things without even talking almost. And we'll give you an example of that. Just last week, I spoke to a modern, rational, well-educated Mexican-American man who I was evaluating for other reasons, and he told me of an experience that he had at age 21 a few years ago. And in this experience, he and his uncle were going, and his father-in-law were going out to work, and they were out in a rural area in California. As they were coming down the road, they saw a being by the side of the road. As he got closer, she didn't move. They thought she was a woman because she was in a hood with the cover over her head. Her arms hung down. What shocked them was that her feet were off the ground. She was in the air. And he stood and they were fixated. They drove right by her. And he asked his father-in-law what he saw. His father-in-law described what he actually saw too. And she did not move. They later worked that day and came back and she was gone. As they began to think about it, she was similar to what in Mexican culture is a woman called La Llorina, who was a woman who was a wandering saint who had lost her children and was suffering for them. She had the garb of that on. Now, this was a collective open vision. And there's also someone in this room who described to me a very similar experience Well, maybe not quite as not exactly the same way to me just yesterday. And maybe if we get in our discussion period, if he feels prompted to, maybe he will tell us about that one too. A very rational, empirical person, I might say. So that's an example of what we're talking about in terms of this collective vision, collective dream experience. Now, finally, let me get to my final part of my paper here, which is the parallel I really wanted to bring this all together with. And that was my experience with the Huicho Indians. In December 1987, I had a chance to study with them somewhat intensely with two of their shamans. The Huicho Indians are a group of 10,000 Indians in central Mexico who have not been touched by any Christian religions. They've been able to avoid that for at least as long as we know. They are literally a race of shamans. They dream virtually all the time. They have visionary experiences. Their life is a daily world, much in the way we've been talking about. And I'm sure with what we've described about Joseph Smith and his group of treasure seekers would be very much at home to them. Now, when they choose a shaman, a new shaman, initiate, he has to go through a 15-year experience to learn all the chants and tribal lore and the mode of treatment and spiritual means by which to be a shaman. It's a very exhausting process. It's worse than medical school, as this one shaman told me. I don't know how you know he didn't go to medical school. I could give him some stories on that one. But anyway, the capstone of this experience, when he gets knighted, or they get the initiation, the final initiation, takes place in an all-night ritual in which the elders of the other medicine men of the tribe gather around the fire. Now, the bonfire is where their most important god appears. He's called Grandfather Fire. And when Grandfather Fire is there, that's the source of divine power right there with him. He is their principal god or deity. Now, sitting at their head then would be this initiate or shaman-to-be who during this night will lead the chants and the ceremonies, along with the singing and the telling of the stories of the great and most sacred experiences of their creation and maintenance as a people. You know, this is their temple endowment ceremony, as it were. He must do it near letter perfect in all aspects, much as he's been doing in previous tests of knowledge and power. However, in the final critical moments in which he is to finalize the passing of his initiation or his test, the following takes place. At one point in the ceremony, now remember, they're all in a deep altered state of consciousness, he pulls forth a feather. It is to be noted that at this time, the other older shamans or elders or medicine men, also in an altered state of consciousness, observe him in all ways in what he does. And at this point, he takes a feather and puts it into the fire. And as he does this, he now is ready to pull the fire out, or pull the feather out of the fire. And as he does it, the feather better not burn. That's the first part. It's very unusual. As he raises the feather out of the fire now, and this is one of the most sacred points of the whole ritual, he lifts the feather out and he shows the feather to the others as well as to himself, and on the face of that feather should be the face of Grandfather Fire. And as he shows Grandfather Fire's face, he then describes it. Now, if he doesn't describe the face of Grandfather Fire and see exactly what the other shamans to be are seeing, he's failed. And then after Grandfather Fire's face, he then has to describe his own face. And if he doesn't describe his own face, if he doesn't see his own face, or if his own face is not there, and they don't see his own face, he's failed. Now, that is, as I said, as best as I can describe it, the crux of their whole initiation. Now, it was described to me by one shaman, Brant Segunda, who's a younger man in his 40s who went through this. He was the one who described this experience for me, and he told me how it happened. He told me, though, of another shaman who went through all of this just like he did, and when it came to him, he was not able to show the face of Grandfather Fire, and he could not even describe his own face, and he failed. It's interesting, this man, this other shaman-to-be, had a lot of trouble with alcohol, and he was addicted to drugs, and that probably was the reason he failed. And he never did go back, was able ever to go back and initiate. Well, now, when I heard this, I was not thinking about Joseph Smith and the Three Witnesses. But when I heard this experience, like a bolt of lightning, it came to me. How is this different from Joseph Smith and the Three Witnesses? How is it different? well, it's different in many ways content-wise, but in a way, it was very similar. It seemed to me that then engaged in collective dreaming and collective visioning, parties can get together and have spiritual experiences that can confirm and ratify the presence of these experiences and make them forever indelible and forever powerful, you see. The key is there's a concordance with every party in the group. And of course we ought to remember that there's powerful mutual suggestion and influence going on between the parties. We know, for example, in studies of dissociative states, when people get into harmony with one another like this, the tendency to influence one another is enormously powerful. Jung, for example, in one of his research studies, noted that people in dissociated or altered states of consciousness are 100 times more sensitive to their environment in terms of picking up cues and responding to them. And so I would submit to you, then, perhaps a new way to look at your faith, if indeed some of these interpretations I've made about dead are true, and what some of the modern Mormon critics are making. Perhaps all these things did happen in vision. Perhaps the plates were primarily visionary, even though there were these actual plates. Perhaps the translation process went on like this. And perhaps the witnesses did do this through primarily visionary experience. Should that really destroy the reality and the spiritual power and testimony and truthfulness of them? My answer would be no. Because I know that after I sat there and I went through some of these rituals, I didn't go through that one I described to you, but I went through some all-night rituals with these Huichol Indians, and I felt the spiritual power of these people. But my own faith that night was immensely strengthened in a very unexpected way, or an unplanned for way that night, about Joseph Smith as a prophet of God and coming forth with the Book of Mormon. Thank you very much.
Dr. Grosbeck has presented some interesting thoughts for us to consider.
Oh, do you
want
to use a
microphone?
Is that a mic? Oh, yeah.
I don't know how many of you are having trouble with such a situation of thinking about what he has presented for you and what perhaps we ought to consider in light of the types of people, as anthropologists would say, would be people who are more in tune with the naturalistic spirit of things. I think as we, you don't mind my notes, but what you're looking like. Yes. But he told us what the procedure is supposed to be here.
They're all taped, so if you use the microphone, it will be clearer.
Clear on the tape, all right.
Yeah.
But you didn't get this earlier. My comments will be limited this afternoon. I think the thing that we need to reinforce here is that we come out of a mindset within our own religion as LDS people, believing very implicitly in the idea of having dreams, of having the spirituality manifested into us, having the gift of the Holy Spirit helping us out in a variety of ways. While we think of these terms, I suppose we might also think of the kinds of people that Dr. Grosbeck has described as being simplistic, perhaps almost heathenish in a certain sense. But I would submit that we find ourselves somewhat in a paradox, often becoming too sophisticated, caught up in the things of the world, and not reverting back to the simple naturalistic concepts of being in tune with the Spirit. I think if we look back, for example, at the New Testament account of what the Pentecostal day was like, can anybody tell us what that was like very briefly? This is not a Sunday school lesson. I just need for us to be in agreement on a couple of things. Does anybody remember that? The day of Pentecost. All right, could you share with us a very brief description?
No, I prefer not.
All right. Does anybody? Could anybody? All right.
The Spirit of Christ's disciples, some people saw it as tongues of flame over people's heads. There was preaching in tongues. The Greeks heard it as Greek, the Romans as Latin.
Okay. All right. Now, were you all able to hear his comments? All right. How about hopping right up here? Are you going? All right. Basically, what he said is that it was a day when certain spiritual manifestations were made in the respective tongues of the various people that were in that particular congregation. The Greeks heard it in Greek. The Hebrews heard it in Hebrew. The Romans heard it in Latin or whatever. So we see then that this kind of thing set the stage for being acceptable within the LDS, within the early church structure. We also remember from the Kirtland Temple dedication as to how people have saw and heard a variety of things that day, a collective kind of experience, very much like what has been described here. And on occasion, we hear the stories, the accounts that perhaps some of you have even experienced of being impressed or spiritually moved to know certain things for your own purposes or to help others. Perhaps this idea of being a seer, being a prophet, does indeed have a special calling, but we know that that isn't always limited because we are given this particular gift as well as individuals to be recipients of certain spiritual things as well. The idea then of having people who behave in such a manner, I think, would lend credence to the things that Dr. Grosbeck has said as to how Joseph Smith was able to translate the Book of Mormon using his seer stones, using the spiritual manifestations that were given to him at this time. As LDS people, I think that we ought to consider the things that he has said. Now, I don't know how many of you have worried about that or not, or if you've read the little blurb in our little program for today. But this idea of having the second sight, the whisperings of the Spirit, or other types of spiritual manifestation have to be taken within the context that we are privy to these things. And those people who have been baptized and have had the hands and anointing laid upon their heads and the pronouncements made, I think are candidates to have these things. That's not saying that there's an exclusive thing that comes from this, but I think within the LDS context that is so. By the same token, we know that this is not just exclusive for us to know other kinds of things as well. Because as we see, there are many people who would be classified as being more in tune with the natural world around them. Those of you who have taken your sociology or anthropology classes perhaps learned about this, of some people's cultures believing that there is a spiritual thing in all things, be they living or inanimate. And I think that this has a common wellspring within the history of mankind. I think also as we look at or listen to and consider the things that Dr. Grosbeck has said, if we look also at the concepts that Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has discussed in her life after death experiences, and Dr. Moody's book of his personal account of Back from Tomorrow, as how he was caught away from his body when he was presumed to be dead, and was able to look at the variety of things that were happening in our world from a different kind of experience that I think there's more out there than we understand or can conceive of at this time. Traditionalist mindset that we have, I think, can be challenged to amend this idea of spirituality as to how Joseph Smith did translate the Book of Mormon. There are connections, of course, with the natural elements that we should be aware of. At this point, Wendy Bagley has mentioned, I haven't had that opportunity to really read this paper in depth and consider it as perhaps it merits. And at this point, we should like to any comments from the audience, any questions that you'd like to direct toward him. You please.
Yeah, there are several witnesses who describe the weight. I didn't go into those. Let's see this. Where's one here? They weighed, how many pounds was it? I'll find this right now. But they were 6 to 9 inches in size. It was stated and weighed 50 pounds. It's something in that category. That's what some of the witnesses have said. In fact, Lucy Mack Smith gave it a price. She said they were worth about $500. Well, yeah, I think that's been done. I'm not sure, but I think that would be sizable. Comment here.
Dale Morgan.
Yeah. So the comment was that there was some object that he had, and it was lead or gold, perhaps, yeah. Okay. Excuse me, comment here.
You talked about this communal experience that people have.
Well, that's a very good question that could come out of this discussion. Do you have any thoughts on that to yourself about that?
My guess would be that the church isn't structured to allow for it, but shrunk them down.
Yeah, I think those are good comments. The other response I have is that, you see, we've replaced the need for this. For example, let's just take telepathy. I don't know if any of you have ever felt you had any telepathic experiences of any kind. That's communication over distance with someone or something or some event. Well, I've felt that at times, but it's interesting, I particularly noted this in my own dreams and other people's dreams. I've seen telepathic, precognitive kinds of experiences in people's dreams. I have no doubt about the experience. It's not a question of maybe. It happens in certain, and there's some good studies where this has been done in laboratories. But the question, but one of the thoughts that's come to me is, for example, the reason why we don't have more of these is we don't need them. For example, we have telephones. Now, I have found, strangely, that one of the best indicators of a possible telepathic experience is a telephone dream. And what better representation of telepathy is than a telephone? If you've got a telephone, you don't need to telepathically get in touch with your friend across town or your mother or somebody. Call them on the phone, you see. So I think there's a whole world. See, we're in a different world setting, a world style of living with the way we approach the world. We approach the world, in quotes, naturalistically, like here and now. It's this sort of, in quote, scientific point of view. And as Ogden was saying, those saints were poor. They were lived in a different life way. So that's another reason for it. Plus, I think the other thing is these gifts are very hard to control and get out of hand. Oh, sure.
I think we also have to look in the historical context of when Joseph Smith did this in the early 1800s. If you remember your American history, this is going to be a time period when there were going to be a variety of new churches come into existence. Somebody has once said that it seems like upstate New York seems to have been a hotbed for religious revivalism going on. And I think in that time period that people indeed were searching for spirituality. We know shortly thereafter we hit the Civil War. And then we are caught in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. And it seems as this man here, Pat Begley, has his question about why can't the church seem to allow for a communal spiritual experience. I don't know if social pressures have said that's not cool to be able to be that way, or is it just a mass hysteria that can come into play here? I don't know, but that's a good question to ask. As we become more technologically advanced, more sophisticated, whatever that's supposed to mean anymore, I think we negate or scoff at the so-called simple things that one has with one's creator or the other elements. We know today that there are many tribes in North America, for example. He's already talked somewhat about Central and South America, which still practice the so-called vision quests by sending their young men and now young women out to get a feel for what it is they hope to become in their life. Not in the vision quest, like we have these little challenger programs for youngsters in trouble. But this was a way of seeking and providing guidance in one's life. Now, not all tribes practiced it in the same manner, but there always seems to have been this element of once coming into maturity that youngsters were hoped to have some spiritual guidance in this way. So this idea is something of a paradox in today's society, something that many youngsters of tribal heritage will hold sacred to themselves and not share with others because of this very problem of not being able to explain, because this person will say, that's silly, that's stupid, how can you believe in something that seems like it's hocus pocus or heathenism?
One more question.
But because I cannot see these things as objective things, there's no place for it somewhere.
That's a very good comment about the double bind that we're in. I wonder if we have just one more comment from Carl Sandberg back there. Carl? Okay, thank you very much.
I hate to be the one to say this, but our time is up, and we have to clear the room. Thank you very much.
If there are any further questions, I'll be around.